You're listening to DraftKings Network.
On April 26th, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yes! The Vanderkoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. Only in theaters April 26th. Rated R.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stugatz Podcast.
I don't know about you, Stugatz, but having everyone in studio has made the feeling around this show feel a great deal better. There has been a general lack of patience with us from the audience because they want their show the way they get their show. And we've had people on Zoom, and the show requires chemistry of people being able to have eye contact and everything else. So I think we're on the other side of it, and I think we get to now be together more often than not. So I hope that the show feels a little more like you are accustomed to 18 or 20 months ago, but that will not stop, Stugatz. The criticism from pouring in. WTF happened to this show? It sucks now. These new people are not funny in the slightest.
Is that guy?
This show was so much better when they were on ESPN.
Is that guy?
It was actually Carson Palmer when the targeting below the knee rule came in, but Dan has to find another way to criticize Brady.
Is that guy?
You're always looking for opportunities to criticize Brady in defense of that guy.
Am I?
Yeah.
Is that right? Go ahead and list all the critical things I've said over about Brady in all the years that you've known me. List them all.
You said he was finished because he couldn't throw the deep ball anymore after week three of a season, I think 12 years ago. I mean, he's put together another Hall of Fame career since. That's it.
That's it. That's the list. Yeah. It is true. I thought he was going to age like every human being at the position before him. And my controversial take is that he wouldn't be a champion at 44 years old. And I've been wrong across 7 years. There's no disputing this. I was like, how do you notice a quarterback aging when it's in the same uniform? Does it happen the way it just happened to Aaron Rodgers in the last 6 months? Or does it happen with the imperceptible lack of accuracy in the deep ball? Hasn't mattered. That team, incidentally, when it comes to the Chiefs and how we talk about the Chiefs, I do believe people need to be scared about underestimating that Antonio Brown sitting out that amount of time and not having actual timing with Tom Brady might make that team extra scary offensively, because it doesn't have to be what he was doing with Mike Evans last year. It could be just Antonio Brown looking a hell of a lot like Antonio Brown from 2 years ago.
Me and Mike were making the point last week that Mike Evans, if Antonio Brown's going to continue to do this, is a great point by you, Mike Evans is their third wide receiver. I mean, what is happening?
Well, it's, I mean, and then Gronk. And then Gronk, after not playing for a while, it is astounding how smart Brady was with where it is that he chose. From this weekend, when you guys were listening to football, how many new voices did you hear out there doing commentaries, Stugatz? Because Greg Olson was in one place. I did not think of the guy who looks like a sitcom dad as a broadcaster, but then I heard him analyzing the game. Where were there some surprises for you hearing the accents and the framings on the game.
Well, it's always nice to reacquaint yourself with the NFL broadcast pairings at the beginning of every season. And so I'm like, who's that doing Lions and Niners? So I had to Google it. I looked it up. Kevin Kugler, I don't think is necessarily a household name. I think he's done Fox games for a couple of years. He was with Mark Sanchez. And I was like, Mark Sanchez doing games. I had no idea.
Sanchez?
Were you trying to do this?
I didn't feed him that one. He was a Sanchez.
That was his nickname.
I know, but that's
the Sanchez.
It didn't sound like what you said, though. It sounded like you just said Sanchez.
Sanchez.
Yeah.
Tomato, tomato. I mean, I didn't say Sanchez. I don't know what you heard. I clearly said Sanchez.
He wasn't, though. We learned that together. The Sanchez.
We did learn that as a show, as a country.
It's looking so good for a while.
Can we just stop?
I mean, he
right
still
now?
Looks good.
Yeah. Oh, he'll always look good. I mean, come on.
I don't know if he'll always look good. I could see a gut coming.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
A little spare tire, as they call it. It's when you have a tummy.
Well, you're crushing at USC and you're in that uniform. You've got that head of hair. It's all downhill from there.
I'm almost glad that I'm not attractive for that very reason.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Like, because there's really? Not far for me to fall. Yeah.
Don't say that about
absolutely.
Yourself.
Well, you know, it would be a lot worse to like be like an uber attractive person and then be ugly and people be like, you used to be so attractive. I'm fine being like plain Jane Billy.
There's a lot of pressure on being really good looking. Not that I know. I'm just saying, like, I could imagine that pressure.
I have enough stress in my life.
I wake up every morning like nothing special. I'm good.
Put it on the poll, Guillermo, at Lebatard Show. Is there a lot of pressure on being really good looking? Aren't there a few? I don't know if you guys saw this, but Rob Lowe is like 60 years old. Rob Lowe. I don't know how, Stugatz. You're not conquering the entire world by being as handsome as you've always been and being able to hear lines fed into your ears so well.
I can barely hear them.
I don't understand why you're not George Clooney with all the gifts you've been given.
What, the booger in my nose?
Just all the gifts you've been given. A never-aging beauty across the eternities.
Speaking of 60, the big 6-0, you want to feel old? Dan Marino, 60.
Still looking great for 60,
still
by the way.
Still looking great.
He looks amazing.
Doesn't
he
look
really
a
does.
Day over 43.
The one that I was going to point out, you've seen the recent commercial with Rob Lowe, right? He was good looking 40 years ago, and he's still good looking. It looks like Rob Lowe is in the John Stamos category of never aging, forever looking young. Mario Lopez is out here damn near 50 and has had so much work done on his face that he still looks young.
Paul Rudd also has never aged.
Yeah.
He has looked the same age since he was born.
But is Paul Rudd considered one of these guys who is beautiful? Because I'm not talking about just guys who haven't aged. I'm talking about guys who don't look like they've aged. And to Billy's fear, he doesn't want to be good looking because in 30 years he might not be any longer someone who's good looking.
I think women find him attractive, Paul Rudd, yes.
But I think that's increased over time by virtue of his lack of aging. I think if, like, in 2005, in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, he's just a guy.
Yeah.
But by the time we get to Ant-Man, it's like, this dude's aged 12 years and looks exactly the same. His attractiveness has gone up over time.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Carell has been the same thing. Hasn't he gotten a whole bunch of Silver Fox? He did for a minute there. I don't know whether he's still getting that or not, but that... The 40-year-old virgin is not aging the way that I thought it was. If you had told me that those guys were going to be, you know, smoking hot sex symbols into their 50s.
I thought you meant how problematic the movie was.
There's some speculation back here of plugs for Steve Carell, by the way.
Have you guys gotten to the bottom of whether or not Drew Brees has plugs or not?
I mean, Dan, I don't think we need to speculate that.
We have to get to the bottom of it?
I do think we need to crown Mike Ryan as our intrepid. Like, he should take the corner of hair plugs as in he bursts into the room.
I have a question about hair plugs, Mike, as the expert. How does that work, right? Are they putting it? Yeah, no, but how does it change color to match the rest of the color of your hair? Like, if I were to get, like, this artificial hair or whatever put into my head the same color as the rest of my hair, as my hair changes colors, like, why wouldn't it look like continents on an ocean?
Well, we have an expert in the room. So.
Well, don't they change your hair with your hair?
What?
Is that are there not
you just dye all the hair the same color?
But I thought that there were procedures involved.
Taking like lower back hairs and putting them on your head.
That use whatever the seeds of hair are from your own head and then put it back in your head.
Yeah, that's why you see a lot of people have the scar on the back of their head when they shave it down, because that's where the hair is thicker around the horseshoe and they regrow hair there.
Yeah, if you're interested in beard replacement, I'd direct you to how I completely wasted Mina Kimes' time last Friday. We did all of that.
That was epic.
So you can listen to that and hear about beard replacement.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I'll save your time. I've already wasted enough time.
But what was the question you wanted to ask, Mike, for the expertise that you require from Meadowlark's plug
Steve Carell. Mike.
Steve Carell. 100%. Yeah. If you watch the first episode of The Office. Now, there's a rumor out there that they meant to do that way. Explain the Daily Show. No, he absolutely had a really good hair transplant. I'm talking McConaughey, and I read McConaughey's book, Real Page Turner.
You listened?
Yep. You have to listen to that book, though. You have to. If I recommend an audio experience, and honestly, it's changed my life, Matthew McConaughey's Greenlight book. The first half is all bullshit. The first half is just a bunch of drunk stories from the bar, and you don't believe a single word, but it's well told. And the second half of the book, there's a lot of great lessons in there. He says that he took pills to regenerate his hair. Come on, Matthew. I may have been born at night, but not last night.
That is a real thing, though. Men can take these like hormone blocking pills when their hair starts thinning, and it will stop the hair thinning process.
Yeah, I've looked into it.
What pills? Just asking for the audience. In case anyone in the audience is interested, exactly. What pills are those?
There's Propecia and
I think the way you know if a celebrity has hair plugs or new hair or a hair transplant is when you Google their name and the first autofill on Google is new hair. Drew Brees right now, the first autofill result was Drew Brees' new hair.
Well, that happened to me earlier in the week when I did Joe Judge laps.
Right.
And that didn't really work out for me.
No,
on Twitter,
it did not.
That was a fake story. That's just a personal experience, though.
Mike Dam wanted us to dig deeper on Peyton. Laughing?
On which Peyton?
Sean Peyton.
Sean Peyton?
Yeah.
There's certainly, he was recently divorced, right? So you got to have a bit of a glow up. Yeah. I mean, he's going through it. You see those shoes? Been there.
How about Breeze? No reason to dig?
TV. Okay. No, absolutely no reason to dig. I mean, it's night and day difference. Keyshawn Johnson, Botox.
What show are you listening to that you thought that I wanted Sean Payton plug appraisals?
It's a good question. It's a good question. It's a good question. Got coach and quarterback confused. Totally fair question.
Peyton Manning probably dyes his hair.
Wow.
Probably.
Yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're really good at this.
Yeah. The only time I've ever been wrong was with Jeff Passan. I apologize on the air. I wore that. I got up close. He was very defensive. So if I've wronged you, feel free to hit me up and we can talk it out. But I can sort out a good lie, too.
Surprisingly old, Jeff Passan.
Yeah. How old is he?
He's like 40 plus, I think.
No way.
Yeah. You'd
think you'd know his age to say that.
That's what I'm saying.
What are you saying?
You know, he has this youthful marionette appearance, but he's like a 40-year-old man.
I mean, the demands of HD television, as you know,
steroids.
Men and women alike, it's really tough. It's really tough. That's why Matt Berry feels compelled to every 3 weeks wrap his hair in plastic wrap and do the damn thing.
Put it on the poll, Guillermo. Does Jeff Passan have a youthful marionette appearance?
He looks like a kid.
It is the hair. It's the color of the hair. It is the dark hair. Again, though, I really want to seize in on marionette. I just want to be clear on what you're accusing Jeff Passan of so that when it lands
on
his lap.
It's not an accusation. That's a compliment, is it not?
Yeah.
Calling someone a marionette.
A youthful one.
No, that's like creepy haunted doll vibes, it's Billy.
It's someone who does not move with human characteristics. It's someone who moves in a bit of a stiff and starched fashion, a rigid, dry cleaned personality.
Would you say Nick Saban has a good dye job?
It's a rusty brown that
He's 69 years old, and when he was in Michigan State, he was like all gray. He's also balding. He does a very good job of disguising these things.
I love the idea of Chris Cody having a hair implant that comes in a different color than the rest of his hair. Like a failed hair transplant, something that
blonde tips or something.
No, I'm just saying like a
jet black,
a cul-de-sac.
I mean, the hairs on my body are not different colors though, so that'd be tough.
A cul-de-sac of burnt lawn color is what I'm talking about. A patch of lawn that hasn't gotten enough of the sprinkler, where the sprinkler doesn't hit, just a patch that time forgot.
As a lawn guy, there's nothing more frustrating than that one patch of grass that just is dead for no reason.
Have you seen this video that went viral yesterday of people cheating with their lawns and just spray painting them green with organic spray? Ooh.
It's called the Augusta groundskeepers, Mike.
That makes sense for that part of the country.
What's wrong with that? Do you judge it?
We've never called them out. In terms of the great cheaters in sports, Augusta groundskeepers.
Do you think that's cheating? Would you not do it? Is it less honorable? As I just learned that Chris, as a lawn guy, I didn't know that that was...
Me and Mike, we like to make the rounds every night.
I know you secure the perimeter at the end of the night, but are you okay with the greening of your grass?
For the people of the audience, what's the name of that spray? Not for me.
Propecia, Procretia. It's cheating. It's not fair. Wow. I got this one dead spot in my grass, and I'm trying everything for. And I'm like a dog with a bone on this one. I'm wrong.
All that matters is that it looks good, though. It's not cheating.
Right.
The goal is to have grass that looks good. If I look out in my lawn and I see green, looks good.
Well, that's my position on getting hair plugs. All I'm doing to the audience is I'm good at calling it out because I'm projecting my own insecurities. Yeah. I want to be Matthew McConaughey. I want to be Drew Brees. I want that in the worst way. But what I don't want is the Dom Capers. Like, I'm not desperate enough to have a bad one.
Like, how much is Brees spending if you had to get... I mean, he might get it for free because he's Brees. But if you wanted to get the Brees treatment, how much do you think that's costing?
Ooh. I got to fly to Turkey for that.
What if it's real?
It could be real.
It's not real.
The real ones know.
It could be real. Why not? He was wearing a helmet all this time, right? He takes off his helmet. In your lawn analogy, if you leave, like... a table out on the lawn, right? The grass dies underneath it. But once you move the table, the grass will grow back. Maybe that's what happened.
He had these strands, these Jimbo Fisher strands of last hanging on. Like,
just Google his playing days. Your hairline doesn't move forward.
He would take
like
his helmet off and it would just be like seven strands of hair.
But it's helmet head to Billy's point.
Exactly, helmet head.
Right.
Now the helmet's gone.
He does look really good, though.
See?
Congratulations.
Thank you,
to
Jess.
Him.
He looks fantastic.
He looks the part.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever he's doing, he did a good job.
He looks younger, but I think we glossed over something, and I need the audience right now in a game that we like to go ahead and play. Google this. Just go to image search and Dom Capers. I just want you to drink this in with us because I don't know whether that's bad advice. I don't know whether that's bad judgment. I don't know whether anyone is saying anything to him. I don't know if he has loved ones that say, look, you are a coordinator. You're someone in the NFL who makes a decent amount of money. How about we not make it whatever it is that you're presently looking at, where it does. It looks like before they got good at this, is when he got it done. That he was in that window before science was really good at this.
Yeah.
It was after the toupee. It's after like the toupee.
That's all right.
At one time in history, somebody would just grab a wig and put it on their head, and that was the way that we did it. And then science. This can't be more than 30 years old, right? The hair replacement thing is a new thing, but I think Capers got caught in a purgatory, in a window there when he got his done.
Oh, back in the day, you had to get a system. Some of us still apply the system. I don't know why. It feels third rail. I'm not going to do it, but just watch baseball tonight. And also Bill Self. Why am I so afraid of saying that person has a system?
Where's the third rail? Is it just an ESPN third rail?
I can't bring myself to. It's the most obvious one ever.
You can't.
It hasn't changed.
You can't just shout it at the end of a gymnastics dismount to end the show.
You'll feel good. Say it.
No.
Say it.
No, I'm
Stick
too afraid.
The landing. Stick it.
Are we talking about Ravi?
Whether you hydrate to live or live to hydrate, Liquid IV quenches your thirst faster than water alone, with three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink plus 8 vitamins and nutrients for everyday wellness, all in a single sugar-free stick. Are you heading to the airport on a long flight, or do you need something after your flag football game? Well, if I was you, I would definitely go with Liquid IV just for the electrolytes so you don't feel run down.
And I know for me, Liquid IV helps me start my day in the morning, and it helps give me the energy to do stuff like cut my yard and wash my car and work out and just face the day. And you can get your energy back while drinking something that's delicious. And when I say delicious, you can pick from flavors like pear, white peach, green grape, lemon lime, and more. Liquid IV is non-GMO, free from gluten, dairy, and soy. However you hydrate, grab your Liquid IV Hydration Multiplier sugar-free in bulk nationwide at Costco, or get 20% off your first order when you go to liquidiv.com and use code DAN at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration using code DAN today at liquidiv.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Don Lebatard.
Dan is getting to his microphone real quick. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Stugatz. I appreciate it. My apologies. I had to run out for a moment.
Stugatz.
Did you eat something?
I did. Yeah. I grabbed some turkey. Yeah. You can hear it in my mouth.
Yeah, you made it seem like you were doing something urgent and said you were just suffering.
I was doing something urgent. Yeah. I went upstairs and grabbed some turkey, and then I ran back down here. I'm sorry that I'm late. It's very unprofessional of me.
Why do you have an entire turkey leg in your pocket?
I do. I walk around here like it's like it's Disney World with one giant piece of turkey at all times.
This is the Don Lebatard Show with the Stugatz.
This man cares about boxing. When I think about boxing, it's one of the first faces and voices that I think of. He's obviously done broadcasting across a number of years, a number of sports. But I think I can say this, Jim, as a historian, and thank you for joining us, your first love in sports is boxing, is it not? I feel that off you, even if it's not true.
I think that that's a fair enough statement. You know, I love all sports by and large, and as you point out, have covered virtually everything at some time or another. But I have a very treasured special memory of my mother taking me into a room when I was 6 years old at an adult party down the street and saying, sit here on the sofa, because you're going to watch the Friday night fights, Sugar Ray Robinson versus Bobo Olson. It's their second fight. And the reason you're going to do this is because if your father were here, he had died the year before. If your father were here, this is what you and he would be doing. So I sat on that sofa and watched Sugar Ray Robinson against Bobo Olson. And as she told me, a guy named Don Dunphy was going to tell me everything that I needed to know about boxing. And I became a big fan, even at age six, and watched Friday Night Fights, sponsored by Gillette, for years afterward. And I have to say that, you know, in all the fights I've covered, and there are hundreds, maybe thousands of them, I haven't counted, I still have a vague recollection of Dunphy's voice and Dunphy's style in my ear. And there was a simplicity about the way that he covered the sport that sort of dignified it. And when I first started calling boxing matches, I thought to myself, okay, if there's anything worth imitating, it's probably what you heard first, what Dunphy did. And I have no idea whether my style is really analogous to his, but in my heart and in my mind, I think he's my model.
Do you know the number of times that you have cared so much about what you're broadcasting that you have cried on air?
The number of times? I have no idea. Too many. You wish that you can be in control of your emotions in every circumstance. But as the host of HBO Boxing, I've had to do several times. I've had to do eulogies, memoriams at the end of the telecast for people whom I dearly loved. You know, I dare anyone to have a relationship, friendship of the kind that I had with Emmanuel Stewart, or to have the kind of reverence that I had for Muhammad Ali, my first true hero in life. and to be able to do those eulogies without cracking up a little bit, that's not in me. I've proven that over and over again. And, I cried on camera before social media, and I've cried on camera during the social media era. And obviously you get a much bigger negative response in the days of social media, but I don't know about it. I don't pay any attention. I don't much want to know what people have to say about that element. It's interesting that you bring it up so early in the interview. But I can't walk away from that. I can't pretend it didn't happen. It was me. It is me. And I've had a lot of boxing fans come up to me and compliment me for the fact that I show that I care.
I love that you care that way. I didn't mean to suggest that it was anything other than you caring when it is, it doesn't need to be that level of grief. You can be moved enough, right? I don't think I have this wrong, whether it's, Golovkin's body punches or Miguel Cotto retiring or Juan Manuel Marquez knocking out Manny Pacquiao. Like you deeply care about what it is that you're watching, the craftsmanship of it and the emotion of it and the courage involved with doing it.
Well, if any of those things brought me to tears, it was Cotto retiring probably. But, I don't think I've ever wept about Gennady's body punches. I might have wept if I had gotten hit with one of them. And I think most people would. But it's there. There's a long record of it. People talk about it on the web and stuff like that. It's not my concern when I go to do a telecast. I'm thinking of information and trying to deliver as broad an assortment of useful and understandable information to the audience as I can deliver.
What do you make of the sport right now at this time? We've been talking for weeks here about the sideshow elements and the way that these are becoming events that don't necessarily, the big pay-per-view events, don't necessarily have to do anything with the excellence of boxing or some of the things that you love about boxing. And yet still it's being made popular with young people, at least in part because some of the people fighting who aren't legitimate fighters, they are super famous and they're luring young people in a way that young people aren't generally lured to boxing.
Well, let me start with my very routine and often spoken first response, which is, I've been in this game a long time and I have read enough and paid enough attention to history to know that boxing has been dead for 129 years. And I expect it to remain in the eyes of many in the public forum, a dead, debilitated, corrupted, and ultimately not essential sport. It's not the way I feel about it. I think that there's a fundamental resonance in the experience of being a fighter or of watching fighters that is tremendously helpful to our understanding of human nature and our understanding of how people will respond in given situations. The situation that you are describing now is, in my view, purely the product of maybe the most corruptive media force I've ever seen in society, and that is social media. And what's happening to boxing has already happened to politics and is happening to any number of other pursuits where legitimate standards and legitimate judgments about what constitutes excellence and what is meaningful and what is essential to society are being destroyed by click numbers. On social media, the only thing that matters is how many people recognize your name and have been lured by whatever it is you're writing or presenting on social media to attach some significance to it. And that's the only vehicle by which we could have arrived at a circumstance where people who have absolutely no background, no credentials, no presentable proof of their value in a sport can be given millions, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars by people whose only attachment to them is that they know their name and follow them via social media. It's a wildly disorienting corruption of what has always been our approach to public life in every area. It used to be that in order to mean something, you had to mean something. Nowadays, you mean something if and only if your numbers reach a certain level.
Do you dislike it?
Sure. I dislike anything that dilutes or destroys value standards. It bothers me that people who have promoted themselves on YouTube and who have not spent 10 or 12 years in the gym learning the legitimate craft of boxing get more attention than people who have. I think that should discomfit anybody with a legitimate standards-based view of the world. But I'm an old horse, and I'm somewhat out of step with what's going on in the world at large right now.
I just can't imagine how a legitimate fighter who trains all his life, is above average by any metric, is someone who merits fame and attention for how he sculpted his or her skill, how they watch the kind of money that the Pauls are making and don't want to throw up on their boxing trunks.
If I were Gennady Golovkin or Canelo Alvarez, and I know that I'm one of the 5 or 10 best fighters in the world, or in Canelo's case, probably the best fighter in the world at this given moment, and I see people who have never had a committed day of training of the kind I've done for years and years of my life, making as much or more money than me, I think I'd have to be very, very discomfited by it. I haven't spoken to Gennady or Canelo or any of the other top fighters I still know about it, but I can't imagine that it isn't wildly discomforting to them to see what's going on and to see that there is an audience maybe larger than their audience, which has zero understanding of what it means to be really good in the ring.
You come from a time where the heavyweight fight especially, but the big boxing matches, whatever they were, the merit of the boxing is what led to it being an event that people would be dressed up for or whatnot. Now you have in the pay-per-view space the event, and the boxing is just sort of tucked into it because that is something that's preferable to young people. But if it keeps the sport alive, even in a diminished state, can you bring yourself to applaud it?
I don't know that that's keeping the sport alive. I mean, the sport is an extremely difficult, arduous, elusive craft that fighters search for years in the ring to find and then to adapt to their own liking and value profile and ability profile, and then go in and with all of that try to win fights. So you say that because there are big numbers attaching themselves to, and it isn't just the Pauls, there are others, but there are big numbers attaching themselves to these people, and therefore that's keeping boxing alive. I don't get that. If undertrained people without real skills go into the ring and fight against each other, to me that's not boxing. Boxing is something that takes place between and among people who have put in years and years of work to honor, value, and learn the craft. That's not what's going on in those fights.
Instead of seeing you as an old horse, I'd like to explain to people, and it's the reason I was asking you about crying and caring at the beginning. Can you explain to the audience, as a man who is a master with words and can really weave tapestries, what it is that you love about this sport? Beyond the couch with your mother, beyond the emotional tugs, the specifics of what it is you love about the fight game.
It's the most human of all sports. It is the sport which is most individualized. Yes, there's gear. You're wearing gloves. Yes, there's a coach in the corner, a trainer who tells you what to do. But when fighters go into the ring and face each other, they are engaged in something that is so deeply psychological, so inner, So much the product of nearly all their lives that they've spent trying to master it, that to a certain degree, and I love this about it, I've watched thousands of fights, I've called hundreds of fights, but I could never possibly say that I know as much about what goes on in there as the two fighters do. When you see 12 rounds of boxing between two guys who appear to be trying to kill each other, I always use Gaddy and Ward as the primary example of this, because if you take a non-boxing person, a novice, and show him Gaddy Ward 1, they're all blown away. They can't believe that people can absorb and deliver that kind of punishment to each other face to face. And when the bell rings at the end of the 12th round, and you see those two fighters fall instinctively into each other's arms, and here I go, you've done it too. But when you see Arturo Gatti and Mickey Ward fall into each other's arms at the end of the 12th round, that embrace says a number of things. Number one, it says, I love you. I am now officially in love with you because I have just spent 12 rounds trying to kill you and watching you try to kill me with your fists. And now we know more about each other than our mothers do. We know everything about what are our weaknesses, what are our strengths, what it is we can do skillfully, what it is we can't do skillfully. That knowledge is all there now and shared between Holyfield and Bo, between Lewis and Tyson, between Gennady and Canelo, between Arturo and Mickey. And then beyond that, there's the question of who won. Judges try to figure it out. I try to figure it out. I worked with the guy I thought was the best judge in the sport for years and years. But the fact of the matter is, only two people really know who won. And they may not always say it, honestly, because they're still feathering their own nest. They're still building a career. They're still going forward. But I guarantee Mickey and Arturo, Canelo and Gennady, deep in their hearts, at the end of those fights, they know who won. And that elusive, almost mystical knowledge is the reason people watch fights. The people who watch fights for the purpose of seeing a one-punch annihilating knockout, they're not real boxing fans. Real boxing fans want to see competition. They want to see the two guys honor each other with their commitment to that competition, and they want to see the nobility that comes from doing something that you really can't do the same way in any other sport. Face off against a man in an enclosed distance, a couple of feet away from him, and say to him, okay, now I'm going to try to prove, just as I know you're going to try to prove, that I'm more man than you. There's nothing else like that.
From that prism, I could see where you would be offended by the pay-per-view numbers some of these things are doing when it doesn't have that kind of dignity and doesn't have that kind of nobility and doesn't have that kind of love or vulnerability.
I try not to be offended by things I can't control. It's not always an easy process. And I do have emotions, and I can be offended from time to time. And, you know me well enough, Dan, after all these years, to probably understand pretty well the kinds of things that do offend me.
Evander Holyfield, watching him fight at 58 years old in that setting is, now you've seen this throughout boxing for a long time, a lot of guys being in the ring a lot longer than they should be, risking their health for money. But did you have any appraisal of Evander Holyfield being knocked out at the age of 58?
He didn't handle his money well when he was making it. He's not the only fighter who's ever done that. He has shown a lot of love and support for other fighters, particularly Riddick Bowe. I deeply, deeply respect that. He was a great fighter in his time. He is, in the old-fashioned sense of the phrase, he's a real man. So given the chance for Evander to suddenly, 1 week notice, have a chance to make a sum of money that he might not have ever been able to access again in his life without saying yes to that, I totally understood why he said yes. And I don't argue with his choice for himself. So, you know, I issue no criticism of Evander. I hope that that the money was great and that this time he will keep enough of it to provide greater comfort to himself and his extended family over the years yet to come.
You mentioned some of them. What do you regard as the best fight that you have ever been in attendance for, the best fight that you have ever called?
The best fight I've ever called. Well, that's too difficult. I mean, you know, the last two major fights I called on HBO were Golovkin, Canelo 1 and 2. And I defy you to find better, more sustained, more thrilling action than you could see in those two fights. But, you know, I've called some of the biggest fights in the history of the sport. The very first live prize fight I ever attended was Cassius Clay versus Sonny Liston in Miami Beach, February 25, 1964. That was called, at that time, the biggest upset in the history of boxing, not just in heavyweight boxing, the biggest upset in the history of boxing. Go 26 years forward from there to February 10, 1990 in Tokyo. And somewhere late in the fight, round 8, round 9, before Douglas applies the finishing punches, I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, the very first prize fight I ever attended when I was a 14-year-old boy was Clay winning the title over Liston in a fight that was called the biggest upset in the history of the sport. Now I'm sitting here with a microphone calling for all American viewers the fight that will dislodge it as the single biggest upset in the history of the sport. And when something like that happens to you, it's almost impossible to resist the inner urge to think this was meant to be. This is a written script from the universe. I was supposed to be in this position calling this fight. Now, there's an element of hubris in that that I reject. It's just a coincidence. It's just an accident. But still, how many times in your life will something like that happen? And how can you resist the urge to think there was a map, that, you know, there was a path by which I got to this point? Either way, to have been at either one of those fights is a privilege never to be surrendered.
Last time we talked to you, you were about to do an event and we asked you, like, where you've been, what have you been doing? And you were saying to us basically, well, look, sometimes the phone just stops ringing and you're retired and there's no big announcement. There's no big spectacle. And we expected to see you back. And then the pandemic happened and we didn't see you do that Triller fight. Are we going to see you again here soon?
If Triller can follow through and complete the process of getting Teofimo Lopez and George Kambosos into the ring, I expect to be there to call the fight. That's a very legitimate prize fight involving last year's Ring Magazine Fighter of the Year, the guy who shockingly displaced Vasily Lomachenko with a spectacular display of skill and innate talent. I want to see him. And I'm told that Kambosos is a legitimate challenger who might have some weaponry that could bother Teofimo Lopez. I want to see that. Triller should want to see that. Fans should want to see that. That is fully legit. So if that happens in New York on October 4, as I've been told is going to be the case, I'm going to be there. And beyond that, I don't know.
You demand that it be a legitimate prize fight, correct? Like, I understand
that's
that.
That's what I signed up to do.
Showtime.
Triller knew when I signed with them that I was coming to them to help them build legitimacy. Trying to make a fight like Lopez Kambosos was a step toward legitimacy. This was not a carnival show. So yes, I was committed to doing that fight and I'm still committed to doing it if Triller can do that. And if they do that, and if they continue to go down that road, and if Triller continues to spend the kind of money that they've been spending on talent, and if a real sports fan like Snoop is still a part of the structure as we go forward, then yes, I'm in position to work with them, but not what preceded it.
You're not doing the circus tent stuff. You're not doing the clown card. I know that Showtime, Ariel Helwani and Al Bernstein lent credibility to those proceedings by being the credible journalists who were ringside. Jim Lampley wants him a legitimate fight. I want to call something that I care about where I can admire the skill level. That is worthy of decades of expertise calling boxing. Otherwise, you'd prefer not to be there.
100% correct. And if I cannot call fights on that basis, I don't want to call them. But if I can call fights on that basis, I very much want to call them. I was a little surprised that it took more than 2 years for somebody to pick up the phone and call and make an offer. And I was happy when it happened. And Snoop is an old friend. I'm eager to try to help him and his enterprise succeed. But Holyfield versus an MMA guy was not the way to do that.
I love that Snoop is an old friend. I love that you're old friends with Snoop. This pleases me. And I love that you're the last remaining guy in boxing holding on to a standard, Lampley, demanding that America have standards. I salute you, sir.
Well, I don't know that I'm the last remaining guy who is trying to uphold a standard. I just happened to be coincidentally, in a position within the past couple of weeks where if I wanted to plant a flag for legitimacy, I could do it. But you noticed, some other people noticed, New York Times noticed, but I'm sure there are millions of people out there who didn't notice that I wasn't there. And for them, maybe it was the event that they wanted to see, and that's fine. Everybody has a different position and a different opinion. I'm just grateful that you understand mine.
I assume, though, that it wasn't the standard of boxing that you were protecting. I thought, and I don't know anything, but I just thought, well, if they're going to turn it into a clown show and then throw the Trumps on it, too, Lampley's not going to lend his name to all of that. But I didn't know it was about protecting the standards that you have for boxing and merit and the art and the nobility of the art.
Well, there's an element of self-protection in that. I can stand here as a sophist and say, yeah, I'm trying to protect boxing and its standards. What I'm really saying is I'm trying to protect my standards by associating with the sport at its most legitimate and presentable level.
Love it, Jim. Thank you so much for making the time for us. Always appreciate it when you grace us with your presence and your eloquence, sir.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Dan.